For the last few months, we've been in the Gospel of John. And today our lesson is from the final chapter in the book of John. It's kind of a coda in a way. It's a conclusion that ties everything together. It gives us a poignant scene of this encounter that the disciples had with Jesus. And so this is John chapter 21, verses 1 through 19. Later, Jesus himself appeared again to his disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. This is how it happened. Simon Peter, Thomas called Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, Zebedee's sons, and two other disciples were together. Simon Peter told them, "I'm going fishing." They said, "We'll go with you." They set out on a boat, but throughout the night, they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples didn't realize it was Jesus. Jesus called to them, "Children, have you caught anything to eat?" They answered him, "No." He said, "Cast your net to the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they did. And there were so many fish that they couldn't haul in the net. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he wrapped his coat around himself and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they weren't far from shore, only about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you've just caught." Simon Peter got up and pulled the net to shore. It was full of large fish, 153 of them. Yet the net hadn't torn, even with so many fish. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples could bring themselves to ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread, and gave it to them. He did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. When they had finished eating, Jesus asked Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" Simon replied, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my lambs." Jesus asked a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Simon replied, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." Jesus said to him, "Take care of my sheep." He asked a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was sad that Jesus asked him a third time, "Do you love me?" He replied, "Lord, you know everything. You know I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. I assure you that when you were younger, you tied your own belt and walked around wherever you wanted. When you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and another will tie your belt and lead you where you don't want to go." He said this to show the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. After saying this, Jesus said to Peter, "Follow me." The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So, what do we do after Easter? That's the question with which we began this morning service. Today might seem a little anticlimactic. The brass aren't here anymore. The lilies aren't here. The flowered cross isn't here. And so what do we do after Easter? And this isn't just a liturgical question, but it's a life question. What do we do after Easter when we proclaim that Christ is risen and Christ is risen indeed, and we find that we still have friends who are facing a terminal illness? We still have friends who are deeply lonely in their lives because of losses that they've had in the last few years. we may still have all kinds of worries pressing down on us. We may have all kinds of anxieties about what's happening in our world and in our country. What do we do after Easter isn't just a liturgical question, it's an existential question. What does it mean that real life still seems so much like life, even after our celebration of Easter? There's a church consultant named Gil Rendell who talks about church dynamics and churches responding to present-day challenges, the fact that the numbers in terms of attendance, you know, aren't what they were back in the 50s when all churches seemed to be busting at the seams and they were building new education wings and new sanctuaries. And what do we do now in a very different era? And Gil Rendell says that churches have a tendency to double down on what they've always done, even if they're not entirely sure it's going to keep working anymore. But he says that when we don't know what to do, we do what we know. We just keep trying harder at some of the same old patterns. Even though some people call that a definition of insanity, it's still human nature. We still want to do it. And so look at what Peter does. Peter isn't quite sure what to do. And so he says, I'm going fishing. And the others think that sounds great. And they say, we're going with you. And there's a deep irony here. Like when Jesus first called the disciples, you may remember that Jesus said, you've been fishing for fish, but now I'm going to make you fish for people and reach out to people. But now, all of a sudden, Peter has gone back to fishing for fish. And the other disciples join him. And then they have a frustrating all-nighter. Reminds me of some of my college days when I would pull an all-nighter, you know, with Mountain Dew and honey roasted peanuts. And then early in the morning, I felt like I was no closer than I was at the start of the night. But that's a college story and kind of first world problems. For the disciples, fishing was often their livelihood and how they ate. And so to have an all-nighter where you don't catch any fish is more than just a frustration. It affects where your next meal will come from. But it must have been deeply frustrating to spend all night fishing and not catch anything at all. And then all of a sudden there's a stranger on the shore asking them if they've caught any fish, encouraging them to cast their net on the other side of the boat. And the next thing they know, the net is overflowing. The disciple whom Jesus loved, who is never named in the Gospel of John. Some people think that this was John who wrote the Gospel, but he never says so himself. He simply identifies himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved, which maybe is the most beautiful kind of identity he could have assumed. He knows himself to be one who was loved and is loved by Jesus. And he recognizes who the stranger on the shore is. And he tells Peter, it's the Lord. And Peter is so excited that like Forrest Gump, he just jumps right off the boat and swims over to where he is. And he swims over to where Jesus is. And the other disciples are left behind to drag the net full of fish. And then when they're there, they see a fire there with fish on it and bread. Even though they've had this miraculous catch of fish, Jesus apparently already has some fish and is already cooking them breakfast. And Jesus says, bring some of the fish that you've just caught, which sounds kind of like an invitation to leave your net there for a while and come here and have breakfast with me. But what do the disciples do instead? They apparently take the time to count all the fish, and they come up with a very specific number, 153. And it's not one of your typical biblical numbers like 40 or 7 or 12 or 144. And through the years, there have been commentators that have speculated about the symbolism and the meaning of the 153 fish. And there are a lot of interesting theories. It gives us an idea of how church leaders spent their time before social media. To me, I think maybe the most significant part of this is that they took the time to count all the fish. Jesus is right there. He's prepared them breakfast, he's ready to feed them, and here they are counting the fish. And isn't this a lot like some of our churches when we get worried? We start counting attendance numbers. We start counting budget numbers. We start worrying a lot about resources. Maybe even spending all night long worrying about these kinds of things. And meanwhile, our risen Lord is right there, cooking breakfast, and inviting us to eat. This is where the church always finds its renewal, is around this campfire with Jesus, who promises to feed us and give us what we need. There's someone I've been reading a lot these days named Andrew Root, who is a professor of youth ministry at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And his contention is that churches often spend too much time worrying about resources. How can we do all the things that we used to do back in the 1950s and 60s when the churches were full? And wasn't that a fun time? And instead, he encourages churches not to worry so much about resources. Don't look down and spend all those time counting the fish in the net, but instead go over to where Jesus is, who's preparing breakfast for you. And he encourages us to have a time of waiting. Don't be so impatient to fix whatever you think is wrong or to come up with new ideas of things that you can try. Instead, spend some time waiting on God and waiting patiently. Because sometimes those all-nighter prayers where you're staring at the ceiling, almost convinced that no one on the other side is listening, sometimes those prayers can end up being the most productive because we were willing to wait for an answer. We weren't trying to rush God. We were willing to wait, even if waiting was hard, even if waiting was frustrating. We were willing to wait. And the hope is that sometime later, in the dawn, a stranger will greet us on the shore and invite us in and feed us breakfast. And this is always where the church is at its best. Trying to facilitate some kind of encounter with Jesus, people experiencing Jesus among each other, with the love that they have for each other, with the welcome that they have, and with the forgiveness. One of my favorite parts about this story is that right after the breakfast, Jesus has a side conversation with Peter. And he says, "Peter, do you love me?" And Peter says, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus asks a second time, "Peter, do you love me?" And Peter says, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And then Jesus asks a third time, "Peter, do you love me?" And the gospel writer says that Peter was saddened by this, that Jesus asked him a third time. Why was Peter sad? Some commentators have pointed out that like different words in Greek were used for love, that at first Jesus was asking, you know, Peter, "Do you agape me? Do you love me with the highest form of love?" And Peter was answering back, "Well, yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you." It's kind of like a friendship love. And the second time Jesus said, "Well, Peter, do you agape me?" And Peter says, "Well, yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you." And then the third time Jesus shifts and says, "Do you phileo me?" Like Jesus isn't asking anymore, "Do you have this highest form of love for me, but do you just have this friendship love for me?" And some commentators would think that that was what made Peter sad. And maybe that's what we're meant to think. But other commentators have said that sometimes we make too big a deal about the different words that were used. And maybe the most obvious reason why Peter was so saddened when Jesus asked him a third time, "Do you love me?" is because of something else that Peter had done three times in a row. Do you remember what that was? On the night that Jesus was arrested, Peter had denied that he was one of Jesus' disciples three times. And so to me, the most persuasive explanation is that when Peter realized that Jesus was asking him this question three times, it brought back the memory of that three-time denial. And that might have been the end of Peter's story. It might have ended in shame that way, but instead, there was this other chance. There was Jesus giving him a chance to affirm, to have Peter affirm his love for him three times, to make up for that three-time denial, to have a restoration, a relationship. And to me, this is always the church at its best. When it's at campfire with Jesus, welcoming each other and welcoming whoever wants to come to the fire and have some fish and some bread, and people discovering that here is a community where there can be genuine forgiveness, where we can have a chance to try again, and people are understanding and encouraging of each other. This is a community at its best. Don't worry about how many fish are in the net. Instead, focus on what's happening here. And at the start of the sermon, I use that phrase, when we don't know what to do, we do what we know, with maybe something of a negative connotation, that we're just kind of scrambling for something, and so we fall back into the old patterns. But there's a positive sense of, when we don't know what to do, we do what we know. When the basis is that love, the love for Jesus, the love for each other, the love in our community, when that is what we know, and we do that, then our life together is blessed. In the next few weeks, we'll begin a new sermon series on the book of 1 John, which was likely a sermon that was written by the same community that gave us the Gospel of John. And so it will give us a chance to explore on a more practical level what a lot of this means. What does it mean to live together in community, to forgive each other, to do our best to follow our risen Lord. And so that will be coming up in the next few weeks. But now, at first, there is a simple invitation to put our nets behind, to put our obsession with resources and how much we have behind, and simply to gather around the fire and have breakfast. All glory and praise be to our risen Lord. Amen.